Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Just one guest up today, a long interview with James Livingston, author of Against Thrift, Why Consumer Culture is Good for the Economy, the Environment, and Your Soul, recently published by Basic Books. Some listeners may be scandalized by Jim's argument, but I like it. In the book, Livingston quotes John Maynard Keynes a lot. Keynes has been reduced in popular thought to a mere advocate of deficit spending and the slump. He was that, but he was a lot more. He was about the best the Anglo-American bourgeoisie produced in the 20th century. His critique of 19th-century capitalist orthodoxy was just what we needed in the 1930s. We need another one today, but since the Anglo-American bourgeoisie is a much more debased formation than it was 80 years ago, it's produced no contemporary Keynes. What Keynes frequently derided is the Treasury view, the austere thinking of the British establishment, which held that the proper response to hard times was belt-tightening, was thought to have been dead and buried in the 1930s, but it's showing plenty of signs of life today. Keynes had no patience for that sort of thing. The response to crisis, he thought, was to spend, not stint. In his most famous work, The General Theory, he wrote at length about an 18th-century poem by Bernard Mandeville, The Fable of the Bees. The poem is a hymn to the virtues of extravagance. It scandalized moralists of its day, as it would ours, if they knew of it. In a prose conclusion to the poem, Mandeville wrote, "The great art to make a nation happy consists in giving everybody an opportunity of being employed, which to compass led a government's first care to be promote as great a variety of manufactures, arts, and handicrafts as human wit can invent." To which Keynes added, "No wonder that such wicked sentiments called down the opprobrium of 2 centuries of moralists and economists who felt much more virtuous in possession of their austere doctrine that no sound remedy was discoverable except in the utmost of thrift and economy, both by individual and by the state. Petty," that is, William Petty, an 18th-century economist, "entertainment, magnificent shows, triumphal arches, etc., gave place to the penny wisdom of Gladstonian finance and to a state system which could not afford hospitals, open spaces, noble buildings, even the preservation of its ancient monuments, far less the splendors of music and of drama, all of which were consigned to the private charity or magnanimity of improvident individuals." Livingston's book is very much in the spirit of Keynes, Mandeville, and Petty, and against the gloomsters of both left and right, who would have us all don hair shirts. Livingston is a professor of history at Rutgers. His 1986 book on the origins of the Federal Reserve System is the best account I know of the creation of our central bank, a rich, detailed antidote to all the wacko conspiracy theories with their dark tales of secret trains ridden to secret meetings that are popular with pseudo-radicals across the political spectrum. I don't have time for that now. So instead, I'll just introduce James Livingston, author of Against Thrift, from Basic Books. Apologies about the rather prominent hiss on the soundtrack. I have a new recording device that I haven't yet mastered. Welcome, Jim. Before we get to your book, I want to talk about populism, both the original and its lingering effects in American political life. You see it across the political spectrum. You see it in a lot of the Occupy movement today, the critique of corporate personhood, the critique of finance in particular, the hostility to the Fed, with the commonality with Ron Paul. You're not a fan of populism. Why is that?
I have 3 major objections to populism. First, I think the populist explanation of economic crisis, both the late 19th century explanation and the present explanation, is deficient. It's not a problem of monopoly, I don't think. Second, I object that the solution to this crisis or the crisis of the late 19th century is to move in an anti-monopoly direction. Break up the big banks is the current slogan. Back then it was abolish the corporations. I think that would cost us in terms of efficiency, the best allocation of resources, because we do have experts at the corporations, which we can put to our purposes, our uses, our aims instead of theirs. That's the second objection. The third objection is that the idea that competitive capitalism and a smallholder economy is somehow better for us in political terms, that is to say a smallholder economy is the necessary bulwark of democracy as such, that seems to me the most specious argument imaginable. It goes way back, of course, to our studies of Athenian democracy, but it's still, to me, makes almost no sense.
1840s America was not a paragon of democracy, was it?
It was not, nor was the 1890s. Now, the populists did have seems to me, good ideas about how to decentralize decisions. And in fact, those ideas were absorbed by both the Democratic and the Republican Party in the early 20th century. Indeed, you could argue, Martin Sklar has argued this, and I think he's absolutely right, that corporate liberalism actually absorbed populism. It didn't displace it. It didn't abolish it. There is, in fact, an anti-monopoly tradition that works within American political discourse, the mainstream. It's called antitrust law. It works up to a point, and so it's still visible, it's still present, it's still palpable in our normal political discourse.
Now, there are a couple of other issues around populism. One is the obsession with money.
Right.
Much more so than production and ownership and that sort of thing. Right. What about that obsession with money?
Well, it goes back to the populist explanation of crisis, which I object to fundamentally, and that is that the quantities of money explain almost everything. The populists argued that there was a shortage of currency, a shortage of money in the late 19th century that accounted for both deflation, they said, and economic crisis. They were wrong. The opposition, the people who founded the Fed, said, look, if you look at money supply in terms of not just currency, not just banknotes, but in terms of certificates of indebtedness, substitutes for money, like stocks, bonds, futures, things like that, the money supply has actually increased. And that's consistent with Friedman's findings as well. The money supply has actually increased. So you can't explain deflation, you can't explain crisis in monetary terms. You couldn't do it then, so according to the founders of the Fed, and it seems to me they were right, and you can't do it now.
And there's another M, moralism.
Yes.
Yes,
there is. This idea that consumer excess caused the crisis, that we consume way too much, well beyond our means, and so forth and so on, it's convenient. It certainly is a club by which we can beat up on people whose wages have stagnated for the last 25 to 30 years. We can blame them for the crisis, but in fact, that's not the cause of the crisis. Consumer excess did not cause this crisis, and so the moralism of people like Robert Samuelson, David Brooks, and the rest, Paul Ryan, to me, it's beneath contempt.
A factoid that would have been useful for your argument that you might not be aware of, but the almost the entire increase in consumption, the consumption share of GDP over the last couple of decades is a result of healthcare, which in the national income accounts is attributed to the household sector.
Right.
So if you take that out, the share of devoted to consumption has been about between 58 and 60% since the early 1960s, and there's been no serious increase at all over that period.
Oh, that's remarkable. I wish I had known that. Thank you for that. No, that's terrific, because in fact you can't use these moral grounds that Brooks and Ryan and so forth use. That's wonderful. Wow.
But, you know, if we look back in the last 30 or so years, we've had a tremendous polarization. And so who are these people who went wild with consumption exactly in the moral narrative?
Well, I don't know. If you can find them, I'd appreciate it. I don't know. I can't see it. In fact, the increase of consumer spending came largely through borrowing. That's true. There's no doubt about it. But it came through borrowing because people's wages and salaries had stagnated. I don't see how that's a moral problem. I see that as a macroeconomic problem. It seems to me that the solution to that problem is to redistribute income.
Now, stepping back a bit to the populist issue, which sort of relates to where we're going to go from there, one of the great advantages of the corporate form is that it's enormously productive.
Right.
And all the kinds of yeoman artisan models that populists left and right love so much are not terribly productive.
Right.
So, but that productivity does create enormous problems of their own, right?
Yes. Yes.
For example, well, you talk about, you know, Conant and going back to the late 19th century, the theorists of this overproduction problem and what to do about it. So tell us about how that emerged in American economic discourse.
Oh, yeah. In the late 1890s, the Americans led the way, actually, in thinking about economic crisis. Not as a problem of disproportionality, not as a monetary problem, but rather as a problem of surplus capital. Conant wasn't the only one. Conant's arguments were the most. Charles Conant, who worked for the New York Journal of Commerce and then went to work for every monetary commission and convention that happened after 1897 or 98. His argument was that crisis was inevitable, and crisis was caused by surplus capital seeking investment outlets where there were a shortage of investment outlets. So that where there's a shortage of investment outlets, he said, he claimed, he was right, the surplus capital would seek outlets that were more risky than might have been otherwise. When they sought those risky investment outlets, then crisis became all the more likely. His solution, of course, to the surplus capital problem was imperialism. That's how he became famous, is his theories of imperialism.
Well, this is Hobson and Lenin, too, picked up on this.
In fact, Hobson read Conan, and in Lenin's notebooks on imperialism, you can read the entry on Charles Conant. We don't know if he read Conant, but we know that Conant was in his bibliography, shall we say. And Hobson borrowed directly from Conant, as did, that matter, Keynes.
Now, how does that relate to the present? You know, we certainly have a large degree of, you know, what we call export of capital going on now.
Right.
If you look at the income statements of the American corporate sector, lots of foreign investment going on, right. Much less so at home. So is this just a new take on imperialism?
Yes. I don't think imperialism has gone away, although I do agree with Bill Warren. I know this will sound controversial, but to the degree that capitalism develops in the world, imperialism declines. That is his conclusion, and I think he's right about it. But the export of jobs, shall we say, that was a direct response to the crisis of the late 1960s and early 1970s, which led to what we call stagflation in the 70s. The momentum of the export of capital increased almost exponentially in the 70s and 80s, precisely because manufacturers here were fleeing what they understood to be high wage costs.
But now, if the problem is a surplus of capital, then the standard remedies for our current crisis, austerity, tax cuts for the rich, corporate tax cuts, that sort of thing, is precisely the wrong medicine.
Yes, absolutely agreed. It's almost, it becomes, to me, I don't want to get hyperbolic, but to me that is exactly the wrong way to proceed. It's so wrong that it borders on the insane.
Why is that?
If we keep transferring income to the already wealthy and to corporate coffers, what they will do is exactly what they have done since 1983 with the increased proceeds and profits they got from the original Reagan tax cuts. They will create a more severe and a more shortened boom-bust cycle, just like they have since 1987. What's happened since 1987? I mean, all we have is this boom-bust cycle. It's just going to get worse if we keep transferring income to the so-called job creators. They don't create jobs. Instead, they invest in speculative markets, which become bubbles.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fact that almost all investment is internally financed by corporate funds. They don't need the savings of individuals. They don't need all these institutional investors on Wall Street. Very, very small amounts of money go through that conduit. It's all internal funds. And there's this basic fact, which is accessible to anybody who reads the national income accounts or the flow of funds accounts, seems to escape the broad,
yes,
thought-forming public.
Yes. And why is that? Wait a minute, you're doing the
interview. Yeah, right. You're supposed to answer that one.
I think it happens because of what I call in the book the myth of investment. It's not as if these people are trying to delude us. They're trying to divert us from the reality. This axiom that if you transfer income to the wealthy or to the corporate profits, investment will follow, and therefore jobs will follow, and therefore per capita incomes will increase, this is a belief that is so deeply rooted, it's like the pre-Copernican notion of the rotation of the sun around the earth. It's virtually impossible to displace it. That's, I think, why. In other words, the paradigm is so powerful, it's so shaping, it's so comprehensive, it's so enveloping that it's impossible almost to get outside of it. That's why I think part of the response to this book has been, what are you talking about? In fact, the first response to the op-ed I did for the New York Times was from Dean Baker, a left-wing economist, who said, well, of course investment increases productivity. You can't have increases of productivity and output without investment. I mean, you just came right out and said it. And in fact, as far as I can tell from the national income and product accounts, that's simply not true.
Well, we do have investment. You know, the corporate,
yes,
investment is about 10-12% of GDP.
Yes.
It was high in the late 90s, fell back in the early 2000s, fell back again in the Great Recession. So, but I think the quantities are the issue.
Yes.
Corporations have more than enough funds to invest.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, they've been, as far as I can tell, on a capital strike since about 1999. And I'm following Martin Wolf here and the OECD, not my own calculations. Wolf has argued in the Financial Times, as you know, and the OECD has argued that these retained earnings, the discrepancy between earnings and investment, has been growing. And so now those retained earnings, idle reserves, as it were, amount to about 8 or 9% of GDP. Yes, I think the level of investment, of gross investment, has remained pretty much the same, somewhere between 15 and 20% of GDP for a long, long time. The proportion of that that is net investment, however, has been declining steadily since 1919. There's no way it's...
Corporations are investing in shorter-lived equipment.
Yeah, but I think the deeper problem, and the deeper promise as well, is that by replacing and maintaining capital equipment, plant and equipment, out of depreciation funds, they're able to increase the productivity of the plant and equipment. So in that sense, that it's as Robert Solow argued a long time ago in 1957, it's actually technical or technological change and innovation that causes growth and not investment, because those net additions to the capital stock are really unimportant. They don't drive growth.
I'm talking to James Livingston, author of Against Thrift, just out from Basic Books. You do engage in a bit of an act of rehabilitation, reputational rehabilitation of Samuel Gompers.
Yes, I do.
In the book, who is not a popular figure on the American left.
Right.
Labor radicals despise him as the author of Business Unionism.
Right.
But you have a somewhat different picture of Gompers. One thing that surprised me, which I did not know about him, was that he sounded almost like a modern anarchist in thinking that the AFL would be some kind of prefiguration of a new society, operating, you know, inside or alongside the existing society.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. Gompers was dismayed by the enthusiasm with which American workers embraced their right to vote and their identification with the two major parties. He thought politics, in that sense, electoral politics organized by the two major parties, was a real diversion from the building of this parallel social structure that he thought of as the labor movement. He really did believe that the labor movement was the embryo of a new society that would someday supersede capitalism. In large part, he thought, by whittling away at corporate profits or at the businessman's profits, so that in the end, wages would equal the entire gross revenue or gross, what we call gross domestic product. Yeah, he was a lifelong socialist, a lifelong Marxist as well. He read Marx. He read Marx a whole lot more thoroughly than Debs did.
He's a more thoughtful person than he's given credit for.
Absolutely.
People
yes.
think of him as some sort of proto-George Meany figure, but he's actually more complex than that.
I think so, yeah. I mean, his politics of more are something that, as I argue in the book, you can trace a thread, it seems to me, from Gompers to, of all people, Vaclav Havel. He really thought that what we needed, that is to say, American workers, the American people, needed was more leisure, more time, and that the labor movement could enforce the compression of the workday, the shortening of the workday, to the point where capital might well be expropriated.
So when he said more, I mean, I think the reading today is he just meant more money and more stuff. But that was it was he had more in mind than that.
Yeah, he talked about more leisure, more education. His fundamental aim was more time, and that's what I think we miss when we look at Gompers, especially from the perspective of today's say labor radicals. He wanted more time, and that's what I think we want too. Enough already with this idea of productivity. Enough already with the idea that we should be producing more. We don't need to produce more. Our problem is distribution, not production.
We're listening to an interview with James Livingston, author of Against Thrift. We'll be back with more after a musical break.
I want to buy.
How does some of spend by the Slits part of a musical counterpoint to James Livingston? And now here's the second part of my interview with Livingston, author of Against Thrift from Basic Books.
I think what a lot of people find scandalous about the book, among other things, but perhaps most prominent, is your embrace of consumer society.
Right.
I'm going to quote some lyrics from two songs we're going to use during the show. One, the Canadian
Not
band...
Not from The Clash, please.
No, this is one, the Canadian band Metric has a song called Handshakes, which expresses, I'm sure you're familiar with this formula, buy this car to drive to work to pay for the car.
Right.
So, you know, this compulsion, this right. sort of vicious circle
right.
of work and consumption, which just feeds on itself.
Right.
And the other is from the punk band from the late 70s, The Slits. Spend, who said, I need something new, something trivial will do. I need to satisfy this empty feeling.
Right.
So,
well, I like them. I like these lyrics.
Let's start with the second part, that consumption, shopping, becomes a substitute for authentic human relations. And it's a symptom
right.
of alienation and emptiness and psychological hunger.
Well, let's begin at the beginning. I think alienation is the human condition. With or without advertising, with or without consumer culture, we are, in fact, alienated from what we believe we can be. That is to say, the urge to become human from infancy on is the urge to become whole, but it's an unrealizable goal. So we're always, of course, we're always empty. We're always trying to fill in something. We're always trying to make ourselves autonomous in ways that we think might work. Now, often enough, that urge, that attempt, takes the form of buying something or appropriating a device, a good, some object. But that too is just being human. There isn't any way to be human or to become human in the absence of objects. That's how we've always expressed ourselves, our desires, what we need, what we want. In that sense, I think Hegel was right, that in the absence of these objects, he said property is the first embodiment of freedom. In the absence of these objects, there isn't any way for us to instantiate ourselves, make ourselves substantial in the world so that we know that we are substantial in the world and others as well, so that others can recognize us. So, yeah, are we alienated?
No, there is this impulse that a lot of people have, like, of the spiritual bent.
Right, right.
Something utterly alien to me, but I know some people, it appeals
yes,
to some.
Right.
That stuff is distracting. And
right.
By stripping oneself down to essentials, one is actually getting towards a more authentic self.
My question would be, what are you being distracted from? Descartes was pretty good at stripping away all those essentials, and what did he find? He found that there he was thinking. Thinking about what? Eventually, and not really all that eventually, pretty quickly he found that all he could do was think about the world. He could retract himself, he could abstain from the world only so far, and then he was delivered unto it again. Now, so the question...
There's food and sex to think about.
There is that. As I conclude the book, there's sex, food, and death, and that's about it, yes. And I get that from Bataille, not from Descartes. Distract from what? It seems to me, again, that if we want to be in this world, and not in some world where there aren't any objects, we call that heaven or hell, if we want to be in this world, then it seems to me we're thinking with, we're thinking about, and we're dealing with objects all the time. Now, some of us would argue that it's the making of things that makes us complete, that makes us human. I would say that misses a lot of what goes on when we buy goods and when we use goods as consumers, and that's a crucial part of the argument of the book, is that is as morally complex as the production of goods. And I think our fetish, our obsession with producing goods comes directly out of the Hegelian Marxist tradition, of which I'm proud to be part of that, but I think we've gone way too far.
Yeah, there's a. I was thinking of this quote from Conrad's Heart of Darkness, where Marlowe says, "I don't like work, no man does, but what I like is in the work, the chance to find yourself, your own reality, for yourself, not for others, what no other man can ever know." There's something about the production
yes.
of an object that creates something about the production of the self.
Yeah, there are two notions in that quote that I think are really interesting, and I'm up against both in this book. First, I think that in appropriating and consuming, using goods, we come to know ourselves in precisely the ways that Conrad is saying are exclusively associated with the making of things. I'm trying desperately in the book to make that argument, to convince people that that's true. The other is that I don't think there's any way to know yourself in the absence of others. I don't see how that's possible. And I don't see how you are abstaining from or retracting yourself from the world in the making of things. The making of things, just like the consuming of things, puts you into the world. It makes you part of the world. And in doing so, it forces you, whether you like it or not, to subject yourself to the scrutiny of others. And I, for one, believe that's a good thing, that this idea that we shouldn't be paying attention to what others think of us is a moral problem, not a moral promise. That is, if we're not thinking about what others think of us...
That takes you to sociopathy if you travel it that far.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you become the ultimate narcissist. You don't care about others' opinion of you? Well, okay, fine. That means that you have power that nobody knows. You know, as I say in the book, you know, if that's what you believe, you're a god or a monster, and probably both.
I'm speaking with James Livingston, author of Against Thrift, just out from Basic Books. Now, what about this, the sense of compulsion, though, that the notion that, you know, read Soot Jolly and all these critiques of the consumer culture and advertising. Advertising creates desires in us that are false and makes us feel compelled to work and acquire and spend in an ultimately unsatisfying, vicious cycle. And you don't agree with that.
I don't. I think
you find advertising a kind of utopia almost, right?
In fact, I say it's the last utopian idiom of our time. I know that sounds outlandish to some. I guess for me, what advertising sells is not an object. And everybody in advertising understands this, and all advertisers and all companies know this as well. What they're selling is not the object itself. They're selling freedom. What they're trying to convince the consumer of is that if you buy this device or this object or whatever it is, you will come closer to what you believe your nature to be, and that is to be an autonomous or free human being. So that the gap between the thing and the desire is pretty wide. The desire is for freedom. Advertising plays on that, for sure. Now, this other question, though, I think advertising should be understood like religion is understood. That is, we don't just dismiss religion because it's irrational, because we know that there are truths in it. We treat religion as a kind of a dream, as if we were psychoanalysts and religion is a dream world. We know there's a truth there. And what we want to explain to the people in that dream world is, here's the truth, and here's how it could be realized. I think that's what advertising, that's how we should think of advertising, as a dream. There's a truth there, we have to interpret it.
Now, these critiques, though, seem to depend on an unexamined notion of authenticity.
Yes.
There's some kind of authenticity at the core of us that's being deflected or contaminated by all these outside influences.
Yes, I do not have much sympathy for the idea of authenticity to begin with. Because it posits this humanity or human nature, which is constant to begin with, and it also says to us that...
But there's also this individual authenticity.
Yes, absolutely. And the individual authenticity is often purchased, excuse my verb, it's often purchased by abstaining from the commodity form. Authenticity seems always, as far as I can tell, to be the derivative of abstention from a world which is commercialized, commodified, monetized, however you want to put it. If we could only step outside that world, then we would find authenticity. So that for the critique of certain musical groups is that they've sold out, or certain novelists, they've sold out. They've actually like entered this world of commodification and become bestsellers. Their albums are bestsellers, their books are bestsellers.
I once heard a story of some polka musicians in Chicago who wanted to go to the old country to see how they were doing polka. And they were using synthesizers and, you know, all kinds of fancy equipment. This is not the real polka.
That's right. And every time you try to peel back that layer, that's exactly what you'll find. I mean, the most authentic music in our culture, in American culture, is the blues. But when did the blues come of age? It came of age with commercial, electrical recording.
Well, a lot of people think when Alan Lomax went deep into the sticks and found like some lone guy playing in his cabin,
right?
That was the real thing.
Yeah,
and everything else was false.
I know, and that's such a joke because the blues used to be performed by ensembles. It was dance music. It was commercial. It was electronic. It wasn't electronic. It was electrical. I find that crazy. It's not crazy, but it's in the 1960s. It seems to me it's that late that the blues is something that we think of with some lone guitarist bent over his instrument. The blues was never understood that way until the blues revival of the late 50s and 1960s, when its authenticity was sought in the Delta before these people actually got into the studio. But the only reason we know about Son House, for example, is because he was recorded. That's it.
Part of this critique also would be that the satisfactions obtained by the consumer culture.
Ah.
You know, first the ad industry creates the desire, then the purchase is supposed to satisfy that desire, but the satisfaction never lasts.
Right.
It's like an extremely short-lived drug.
Right.
So there's something artificial and damaging about that kind of that kind of utopia. What do you say to that?
I think that's true in the sense that I don't think any human desire is obtainable or realizable except in that fleeting moment, say, of consummation or satisfaction. Human desire,
sexual satisfaction, doesn't last very long.
That's right. You can say that about the purchase and the use of a consumer good, but the way that I observe most people using consumer goods, their cars, for example, they take good care of these things. They don't, you know, and they derive perhaps diminishing returns of satisfaction, but they derive satisfaction from these things over time. It's not momentary. It's not fleeting. On the other hand, I would go back to my original statement, and that is that human desire as such is insatiable. It's never going to be at rest. It is impossible. And for us,
any Lacanian school child knows desire is an unsatisfied remainder.
That's exactly right.
And unsatisfiable.
That's right. That's exactly right.
I guess a lot of this critique emerges, at least in this country, from a deeply Protestant critique of pleasure and notions of austerity and self-reliance and all those things that, you know, whether they come from John Edwards or John Calvin or Ralph Waldo Emerson even, there's this suspicion of sensual pleasure at the heart of it.
Right. I think that's right. Now, Luther was pretty good on the question of sexual pleasure, but otherwise, yeah, I think what the Reformation did was to replace the human capacity to know God through reason with the idea that what made us human was our ability to transform the world or to produce value through work. Luther called it a calling. Calvin called it many other things. The Reformation, in that sense, introduced what I call in the book the principle of productivity, that from each according to his ability to produce, to each according to his to the value that he has produced. In other words, consumption had to be authorized by prior effort, by prior work. If you didn't work, you were not deserving of a share of the society's goods.
And according to conventional economic orthodoxy, one is paid according to what one produces.
Right. The relationship between productivity and income, or effort and reward, is supposed to be transparent in contemporary thinking.
And it doesn't work out that way, but it's supposed to.
Yeah, exactly. Now the Protestants, you know, we're probably closer to the original Protestants, at least. We're probably closer to the truth than we can be, because in our own time, of course, the relationship between productivity and income is completely askew. It's nowhere near transparent. On the one hand, you have Wall Street traders making millions, and on the other hand, you have people whose productivity, say, on the shop floor, on the assembly line or in the office, has increased exponentially over the last 25 years, and they haven't seen a raise in 10 years. So there's no discernible or rational or transparent relationship between income and productivity, so that living by this principle of productivity that the Reformation introduced to us seems to me, at least by now, irrational.
And so you want to smash this icon of productivity?
I do.
And I'm talking a bit about your utopia now, outside of advertising, redistributing income, right. Separating income from work,
right.
And in the spirit of Keynes, right. Somewhat comprehensive socialization of investment.
Right.
So work that out for us.
Well, I think the first step, and only the first step, is a redistribution of income. If we don't do that, then we leave these huge piles of profits in the hands of people who have ruined the economy over the last 25 years.
And who literally have more money than they know what to do with.
Exactly. No, I mean, that's right. I think literally that is absolutely true. Okay, but that's just the first step. If we simply redistribute income and leave all other things intact, other things being equal, we will lessen the chance of crisis and a boom-bust cycle and its repetitions. But we're not going to get at the heart of the problem. The heart of the problem is that we now have to, if we want balanced growth, and if we want it without the environmental consequences that we can now witness, we have to socialize investment. And that means at least that we now take responsibility, we the people, the majority, take responsibility for discussing what we want from growth. And then beyond that, perhaps, whether we want growth. We have to take responsibility for this now. We have socialized bank capital pretty clearly with the bailout, but before that, with our own guarantees of our own deposits, right? The FDIC is financed by us, the taxpayers. We've already socialized bank capital in that sense. There's no reason for us not to then take responsibility for it. So yeah, we have to stretch our notions of what profit is to begin with in two ways. First, what are the externalities, environmentally speaking, and how does that cut into our ideas of profit? The other would be, it seems to me, is how to make a private-public partnership, say, on the rebuilding of infrastructure or a rebuilding of our occupational structure possible. And that private-public partnership is a way of socializing investment. It's not a way of handing over to, you know, the capitalists the more profits. It's a way of modulating their idea of return on investment.
So now, we've talked earlier about the quantity of investments, but
right.
Also the quality matters. And
exactly.
We have plenty of capital tied up in the production of cars and SUVs, and not very much tied up in the production of high-speed rail.
Right, right.
So when you talk about the socialization of investment, is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. No, if we want growth that is balanced and is environmentally sound, shall we say? Yeah, we'd have to do that. There's no way around it. But that seems to me that would be consistent with Felix Rohatyn and John Kerry's proposals for infrastructure banks or infrastructure spending. As driven by, financed by, government spending. Infrastructure, it seems to me, is transportation. So, yeah, absolutely.
You have been criticized for not paying much attention to the ecological dimensions of mass consumption. There are a couple of pages about it, but not much in the book.
Seven, by my count.
Okay. I didn't count, but evidently you've been motivated to count. Do you feel that it's oversight? Do you feel not qualified to talk about it? Do you think it's not important? What's the story?
I think it's massively important. I think it's certainly the button that most reviewers want to push outside of the Wall Street Journal anyway. And yeah, I think the reviewers that I've read so far are right to say that there's not enough in this book about it. But what I was trying to do was set up an argument. I was trying to say, look, you cannot blame excess consumption, and you can't even blame consumer culture. Consumer culture is not the problem. The problem is the way that production is driven by this pursuit of wealth in the abstract, what Marx called exchange value. That's the real problem. What we have to do is debate the purposes of growth. And once we do that, we can introduce into our discussions this idea of, like, what are the externalities? What are the costs? And those costs include environmental costs. Either we socialize investment and get ourselves into this discussion, or these environmental problems will never go away. We cannot solve them as consumers except through our boycotts.
We're listening to an interview with James Livingston, author of Against Thrift. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. We'll be back with the conclusion of my interview with James Livingston after a musical break.
When the cameras roar, can you face the pavement?
That was some of Handshakes by Metric. And now here's the conclusion of my interview with James Livingston, author of Against Thrift, from Basic Books.
Yeah, sometimes in bad moments I think that the ecological crisis is a kind of way for a certain small group of Marxist intellectuals to revive crisis theory, but also to revive the Protestant critique of consumption. It's a way of prescribing hair shirts for all.
Absolutely. I agree.
And, you know, obviously I think the environmental crisis is real, and the climate crisis is very real,
right.
Already upon us, but there also does seem to be this unexamined emotional energy behind it that comes out of this Protestant dislike of self-indulgence.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right, and my experience with some of my critics would bear that out, absolutely. I was interviewed for this documentary about the so-called freegans in Brooklyn who do dumpster diving every night and recover food that's thrown away, and their watchword is save. We need to save this, we need to save that, and we need, in so doing, to save the environment. I think our problem is that we believe that character and rectitude is organized around the repression of our desires. We know that somehow to build our characters we need to delay gratification or defer gratification. I think that served us pretty well for about 400 or 500 years now. It's what Freud called the anal personality. It's what Faber called the ascetic personality. It served us well. Under the circumstances we face now, it cannot serve us well. This constant urge, which is a pleasurable one, by the way, this urge to defer gratification, to repress our desires, is destructive. And not just psychologically. It seems to me if we don't redistribute income and enfranchise consumers, and in that sense enfranchise consumer culture, we are going to drive this planet to destruction, because we're handing over our futures to these 1% of these people in these buildings who only care about a bottom line.
But you take pleasure in stuff.
I do.
Good stuff.
Yeah, I can't afford most of the stuff. But,
but I think there's a certain kind of social critic who finds that disturbing. That means you're a shallow and greedy person.
It could be that I am a shallow and greedy person. Who knows? Only the dead man is happy. I
take pleasure in stuff too. So I'm not one of those critics.
I think there is a very powerful strand in social criticism. And it is by no means confined to the puritanical right. It seems to me, as you were suggesting earlier about the Marxists interested in the environment, that it's more powerful on the left than it is on the right. That indeed the urge to austerity of our time, of the last, say, 3 to 4 years, this urge to austerity comes mostly, as far as I can tell, from the left, not from the right. And it always comes in the name of purer character and a more verdant environment. So, you know, I can live with the accusation of being shallow, because I like to I like to indulge in goods. I just wish I had a little bit more money to indulge in more.
Well, don't we all? In your redistributionist paradise, we would all have.
That's
more,
right.
Or
that's right.
Most of us would have.
I was about to say redistribution is the first step.
But you explore this some of the book. But Americans, you know, reportedly love shopping. There's a nation of consumers. The President Bush told us to go shopping after 9/11.
Right.
Yet there's also a guilt about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's our old friend, the Protestant inheritance, I guess, that people feel guilty about that extent, that kind of shopping.
Okay.
And I was thinking about the institutions where most of us do that shopping. Most Americans shop not in embedded in urban environments, not in city streets, but in shopping malls, which are enclosed, access-controlled, climate-controlled,
right.
Surrounded by parking lots. So it's a strange separation of the consumption function from the rest of life.
Right. It's interesting because those goods are always brought back into a social milieu, typically families, sometimes neighborhoods as well, where the isolation of the shopping is over. Yeah. So I'm not a fan of malls, mind you, but I don't think that the critique of malls, either architecturally or, shall we say, socially, amount to much, because the department stores of the older cities were already, as Walter Benjamin was trying to convince us of, they were already malls. They were already these palaces of art, almost. If you look at the Carson Pirie Scott building or the Marshall Field building in Chicago, for example, these were already malls in the making.
A lot of modern American shopping seems driven by bargain hunting rather than a sybaritic pursuit.
Yes, indeed. I agree. I was out on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. I was out at 1 o'clock in the morning that morning. I went up to Macy's. And it was pretty intense, and yet everybody in that store, at any rate, up by Herald Square, was extraordinarily friendly, jovial. There wasn't any jostling. There wasn't any pushing and shoving.
Nobody was shooting each other over in DVR.
No. It was quite remarkable. And if you went out on the streets, on 34th and they were mostly tourists. I mean, certainly in Macy's, as far as I can tell through the interviews I did, most of the people were from the outer boroughs. So in that sense, it was already a kind of tourism. They were coming into the Macy's, in Manhattan. But on the streets themselves, it was obvious that most of the people were not there to shop. They were just to watch.
I'm speaking with James Livingston, author of Against Thrift, just out from Basic Books. Something that doesn't get much more than a passing mention in your book is the American current account deficit. We don't make much here. We have to import a lot, and we borrow the difference. And that is not economically sustainable. At some point, the United States is not going to turn into Greece anytime soon, or Argentina, some of them were hysterical comrades were saying, but still, it is not something thoroughly sustainable. On the other hand, the rest of the world kind of depends on us to do this. Should we think about this in our embrace of consumption?
Yes. I think this the trade deficit is something that goes with the territory of being the indispensable nation. Great Britain did it in the 19th century, and everybody wailed about it. It's part of the role of the indispensable nation. So I don't think there's too much to worry about there. The financing of it, I don't think we can sustain consumer borrowing as the way to balance the current account deficit. I think the way to balance the current account deficit is to redistribute income and continue then to run a trade deficit and allow consumers to buy these imports. That's fine with me. The other side of that, of course, is what should we do about the loss of manufacturing jobs is really, I think, the implicit question here. And I think the answer to that is, well, we have two choices. One is to repatriate manufacturing jobs. You can do that in all sorts of ways. You can use tariffs. You can, all the ways we can do it. I think that's a mistake. I think the better thing for us to do is to redistribute income and then move forward with this idea that one's income should not be tied to or determined by one's production of value through work. We're going to have to learn to detach income from work one way or another. And this seems to me, the deindustrialization of America seems to me a good opportunity. We don't want to go back to backbreaking work. I don't see the point of that. I do see the point of allowing other nations to develop because we have exported manufacturing to those places. So I think, in fact, this is a win-win situation. If we can continue to run the trade deficit, I don't think we have any choice in that matter anyway. But we're going to have to move beyond this idea that manufacturing jobs are the ones that we need.
And then finally, at the end of the book, you have this chapter about Bataille and the hamburger.
Yeah.
I noticed that, it's very common among, particularly folks on the left, to adopt a vegetarian or a vegan diet,
right.
And I think it's part of the Harris shirt stripping down.
I think that's absolutely right.
But for you, it was a falling off the wagon.
Yes, it was.
Talk about the wagon and your falling off.
Well, as I try to suggest, this is a parable in this. I hope it functions that way. It's an autobiography that serves as an index. I hope to the kinds of choices that are available now to Americans.
Representative man.
Well, I don't know if I want to go that far, but yeah, yeah. You start donning that mantle, and then you're in big trouble. I realized in the waning years of being a parent, my kids are now grown, more or less, that I had been abstaining from eating meat for reasons, for pleasurable reasons. I got great pleasure out of this abstention. And I knew at some level of my being that this allowed me to build my character, this abstention, this abstemiousness, if you will.
It's a form of saving.
Indeed, it was, and it is. I think there's a very strong correlation, as you've already suggested, between vegetarian diets and this idea that we need to do less to the earth. Well, after parenthood, as it were, I kept asking myself, what was that about? Or what is it about? I was still not eating mammals. And I realized that I was repressing certain kinds of desires, certain kinds of luxuries, for reasons that had passed. Just as we now repress certain desires and defer certain gratifications, even though it's no longer necessary to increase productivity or to increase growth or for any other economic reason. So, with that in mind, I thought what I should do is test myself and my desires against this world of where everybody's been eating meat all these years and I haven't. So I designed the hamburger experiment, and which was.
And you didn't go to McDonald's for this experiment.
No, I thought I thought
you're gonna fall off the range.
That's right. I thought I should go high end. So I went to my girlfriend and I went to the Homestead on 9th Avenue in the Meatpacking District, appropriately enough, where on the dinner menu you can get a Kobe beef hamburger for $39. So I ordered the Kobe beef hamburger, and after 30 years I took my first bite of one, and I thought it was pretty wonderful, even though it was way underdone and I had to send it back to the kitchen to get it to a place where I could actually chew on it as opposed to like simply swallow it as if it was liquid. My sense of it was that this was going to be a slippery slope, that right, as soon as I started eating hamburgers, I'd start eating all sorts of other meat. It didn't turn out that way, actually. And I realized that the pleasures of indulgence were real, and they were no less real than the pleasures of renunciation, which I had practiced for all those 30 years. But they didn't lead to, as far as I can tell, dissolution. I'm still more or less intact as a human being who has a moral compass and bears a moral personality. So what I was hoping in telling that story was, the title of the code is called Bataille Made Me Do It. What I was trying to say is that the eating of meat is a luxury that I can afford, and it seems to me the luxuries that we can now afford have become in some ways necessities. That is, the luxury of spending, the luxury of expenditure, the luxury of engaging and indulging our desires doesn't even look like a luxury to me anymore. It looks like something we need to start doing, if we are to save the economy, to begin with, and in the longer term, the earth itself.
And you draw pretty heavily on the more utopian side of Keynes.
I do.
And his essay, The Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren.
Right. The Dilemma of Modern. Okay, sure.
We are now in the land of his grandchildren.
Yes,
and we're
that's
not
right.
doing a very good job of fulfilling his fantasy, are we?
No, we're not. You're right to say that I draw on. I think the General Theory is a wonderful book, but it was written for economists. I think for me, the three key texts are The Treatise on Money of 1930, The Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, also 1930, and then the piece he did for The New Republic, April 14th, 1932, called The Dilemma of Modern Socialism. That last piece is where he's most explicitly on the side of socialism, and most explicitly saying what I'm trying to say in this book, and that is that redistribution, consumer culture, these are not utopian at all. These are practical, necessary solutions to the crisis we're still living through. He said the same thing in 1932. He said, we have the capacity to produce more consumer goods than we need, but we will never be able to do it until we readjust our priorities and see that we have this extraordinary productive capacity. We might as well use it. we might as well learn to live with the leisure that the compound rate of interest has given us. That's what he says in the Economic Possibilities essay.
Being financially oriented. But he also said in that essay, My Early Beliefs, that he was and always will be an immoralist. Would you embrace that side of him as well?
I would, in the sense that, I think what Keynes was getting at there was that he called the profit motive a somewhat disgusting morbidity. In other words, this abstemious saving mentality, he said, it has served us well, but it has outlived its usefulness. I'm saying the same thing in the book. Saving has reached a point of no return.
Did the road of excess lead to the palace of wisdom?
I should hope so.
Thank you.
I was James Livingston, the professor of history at Rutgers and author of Against Thrift, recently published by Basic. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Weekend Without Makeup by the Long Blondes, who inspire us to a meditation on the distinction between wants and needs. Till next week, bye.